Refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. This is the July session 2018, the third full talk, today starting with Hongzhi. This one is titled The Amazing Living Beings. Our house is a single field, clean, vast, and lustrous, clearly self-illuminated. When the spirit is empty without conditions, when awareness is serene without cogitation, then Buddhas and ancestors appear and disappear, transforming the world. Amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. How amazing it is that all people have this, but do not polish it into bright clarity. In darkness, unawakened, they make foolishness cover their wisdom, and it overflows. One remembrance of illumination can break through and leap out of the dust of eons. Radiant and clear, it cannot be diverted or altered in the three times. The four elements cannot modify it. Solitary glory is deeply preserved, enduring throughout ancient and present times, as the merging of sameness and difference becomes the entire creation's mother. This realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings, all appearances merely this field's light. Truly enact this reality. Our house is a single field, clean, vast, lustrous, clearly self-illuminated. So a genuine A Dharma teaching is said to have three characteristics with which you can rely on to gauge whether it's authentic or not. Because there's so many diverse teachings and so many traditions over so many years now. And basically, the three characteristics are no self, impermanence, and nirvana. Or selflessness, the truth of continual change, and dukkha, suffering. But also, a Dharma teaching that's genuine will never collude with the limited, biased views we have about ourselves. It will never reify, it will never confirm the small ideas we have about who we are, what our capacity is. Dharma is good news from top to bottom. There are no broken people. There are no outsiders in the field of the Dharma. So limited bias views, well, basically three categories. We either inflate ourselves or we inflate others. We deflate ourselves or we deflate others. Or we somehow just ignore. We ignore, we don't see, we filter, we screen out. And it's interesting to look into why we do those things when we do them. The Dharma does not agree with any of our conclusions. Teachings will not confirm it. Teachings say you are your conditions and that and just rolls on without any ending. You needn't be identified with thought, sensation, feeling, but there's this body sitting right here. Hongzhi's words aren't random. There's a precision that is part of the art of talking about the Dharma. We want to be careful. Words fall short, but words can fall more or less short. So he said, "Our house is a single field, clean, vast, lustrous, clearly self-illuminated." Clearly self-illuminated. That's direct pointing. Clearly self-illuminated. Following the breath is a dualistic instruction. Following the breath, it's a little bit, communicates a bad idea. Or to be mindful of the body. It's a misleading phrase. If you are following the breath, then you must be behind it. If you're behind the breath, where are you hiding in there? You're following the breath from this part of the head, this part. Where are you hiding in there if you're following the breath? It's not very accurate. So we say, feel the breath with the breath. Feel the breath with the breath. Even more intimately, we could express it, the breath is feeling the breath. The body is knowing immediately the body. We say aware of whatever, and it's just a manner of speaking. So the phrase clearly self-illuminating, you could substitute self with spontaneous or natural. Actually, the Chinese character for self doesn't mean individual self. It's synonymous with naturalness or spontaneity. Clearly, spontaneously illuminating. The third ancestor said it with this phrase, the Faith Mind poem, all is self-revealing, empty and clear, without needing to exert power of mind. Dogen Zenji will often say, if you take up a single phrase and see it through, that's sufficient. A single phrase of good teaching, and I think that's one of them. All is self-revealing, empty and clear, without exerting power of mind. This is really straightforward. Feel your toes. Where did you feel them? Hear sounds. Where do you hear them? One of the subtlest levels of grasping, you know, the Buddha talked about different levels of letting go. And he first talked about our clinging to things as a kind of suffering. Can't hold on to them. Then he said, contemplatives, people who practice, tend to cling to views. They let go of whatever else they used to own, and then they hold tenaciously to concepts about reality. So he said, the work of contemplatives is to let go of views. There's a subtle level that's a greed for knowledge, where we see that there's a way in which we reach out with consciousness to try to touch the world. We don't let the world illuminate itself. We don't let it come to us, but we want to reach out. We feel that. We're reaching out and experiencing the world. And this obscures the way consciousness, the way awareness, the way self-nature actually is. Because you're trying to do something that's actually doing you. You're making effort where effort is like a heater in the summertime. Ko and Edjo, in that wonderful chant we're doing every other day, the Treasury of Illumination. He says, the treasury of illumination in which body and mind are single. Isn't that the same meaning? Body and mind. Not just the sort of wordy brain emissions. That's an aspect of mind. A body and awareness. The treasury of illumination, your life in which form and emptiness, body and mind, never split. Hongzhi continues, when the spirit is empty without conditions, when awareness is serene without cogitation, then Buddhas and ancestors appear and disappear, transforming the world. What do you notice when your mind and body settle down? What reveals itself? Kind of like a snow globe. I like this metaphor a lot. You shake up a snow globe, can't see a whole lot of what's going on, and then you set it down. And then in time, it clarifies, self-settles. And what do you notice? It may not be insignificant. What's the experience of the body after days of sitting? Feel the quality of the body right now. Do you experience it the same as you did when you first came in here? What's the experience of other bodies? Bodies of trees, bodies of Ryoki bowls, bodies of the Sangha, with clarified awareness. Does your life feel the same? You know, sometimes in thinking about the fruits of practice, we want something to just whack us over the head. Like, we want to know so clearly that we're getting somewhere. We want, like, the best mystical bright essence to descend upon us and shoot out of our ears. Like, we want to know for certain I'm on the right track. But an appreciation for the subtle. Because your life is subtle. Does your life feel the same as it did when you first came in here? Is it the same life? Is it the same world? Is that the sense that we wake up each day to the same old world? It's just there. It's just there, just this thing that is there. And maybe I feel a bit more open towards it or not, but basically the same old world. Is that really the way it is? When awareness is serene without cogitation, then Buddhas and ancestors appear and disappear, transforming the world. We can be so busy meditating. Chogyam Trungpa, in observing Westerners in the way they practiced, he said, you should sit down a little bit more folksy. That was the phrase he used. He saw us bring this sort of, like, really do something now. And that got in the way. So your meditation should be a little bit more folksy. So you could try that. So if throughout this session you've been, you know, really concerned about your posture being really straight, and, you know, the old text says the nose in line with the navel and the ears over the shoulders, I've never gotten that. Just let yourself lean a little bit. Just like, do a little Zen cash. You might be surprised at how that affects your quality of being. So busy doing meditation. What's doing with the one doing the meditation? So, if asked, pretend I'm asking you, where is the one doing this practice? Where would you point? Okay, saw somebody scratch their nose. This quickly devolves into the absurd. Where would you point? A face, a nose can't do meditation. Could it? Does a skull do meditation? Does the brain do meditation? The brain. See, maybe it's really the brain that's doing meditation. So maybe a lot of neuroscientists would agree with that. It's the brain that meditates. It's the brain that does everything. All brains throughout space and time, all honored ones. So it's the brain, so then the body is the brain's meat puppet. Anybody remember Ninja Turtles? Krang? Yeah. So the body is the brain's meat puppet. So that's, maybe it's the meat muppet. It's like meat. It's meat muppets with like those old men up in the balcony. That's like the inner critic. The old men in the balcony are kind of looking down, sneering at you, hurling insults. This is like my morning zazen. Meat muppet with the old men in the balcony hurling insults. But seriously, who is meditating? Who is meditating? There's like, of the Soto chants that we do, like the one we did this evening, Dogen Zenji's teaching, there's so many times this phrase, turn around the light to shine within. Who is meditating? And what recognizes that? That can be an all-consuming question. You could say the point of meditation is to be free of the meditator and to outgrow the need to meditate. But you got to go step by step. Hongzhi continues, amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. Amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. So through your zazen, you experience the expose of the self strategies. There's so many, there's a whole cast of characters, aren't there? You might see that you want to be outstanding. So I thought about that word, I never quite got. Like, oh yeah, you want to stand out. You want to be outstanding. You want other people to recognize just how outstanding you are. And it's pretty silly in this context, but still happens. You want to be the serenest. You want to bow the most gracefulest. So we had a real macho wave here in my early days. Actually, in the early days of the monastery, like, the balance of gender was way tilted. And there'd often be one or two women, and I pitied her because of how much testosterone was in the air. But so in the macho days, we would be competing with each other to see who could move the least during wiggle bells. So those of you who do move during the wiggle bell, or don't move, that's great. But we would be doing something like this. Like, ding, 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 ding. I knew you didn't have what it takes. Another self strategy I know too well. I call the constipated hermit. That's not very loving, but we'll just call it the constipated hermit. You know, being around other people sparks so much uncomfortable judgment and comparison that the constipated hermit just wants to get away from everyone, just wants to be in peace alone. And there's a wisdom there. There's a wisdom there. I have compassion for this part. I mean, I take my constipated hermit time. Maybe it's a time we need to go through. But when this is a deeply held belief that that would be an ideal way of practice, it's helpful to examine it. So I think of Dogen Zenji's words. He said, wanting to depart samsara, people, wanting to depart samsara to get to nirvana is like looking south to see the North Dipper. Wanting to depart samsara to get to nirvana is like looking south to see the North Dipper. Amid living beings is the original place of nirvana. You won't have confidence that it's genuine unless you bring it to life in the midst of your challenges. And otherwise, there's lingering doubts. It's part of the kind of the logic, actually, of austerity. Sitting up all night. Sitting out in the forest in the dark, sitting through the wiggle bell is, I want to put this equanimity to the test. I need to see for myself, does it function? Does the rubber hit the road? Hongzhi, how amazing it is that all people have this original spaciousness but don't polish it into bright clarity. How amazing it is that all people have this but don't polish it into bright clarity. In darkness unawakened, they make foolishness cover their wisdom and overflow. How amazing it is that people don't polish this into bright clarity. In darkness unawakened, they make foolishness cover their wisdom and overflow. A few centuries earlier, a woman in the Bun Dzogchen tradition gave this teaching to her disciple. All phenomena of existence appear from awareness into awareness and are themselves awareness. All phenomena of existence appear from awareness into awareness and are themselves awareness. They appear clearly, This clarity is much brighter and clearer than the light of 1,000 suns and moons. What does that mean? I mean, I'm not squinting my eyes right now. How is it brighter than the sun and the moon times 1,000? She said, this great light is integrated with every consciousness and perception and purifies the darkness of ignorance. No matter how deep ignorance may be, it can be purified instantly. Once the darkness of obscurations and defilements has all been purified, that is called the Buddha nature. This Buddha nature has purified the root of samsara. It doesn't matter whether you're an early Buddha or a new Buddha. Anyone who achieves Buddhahood has equally purified the root and is equal in the natural state. And then that disciple digested those instructions. And then later, and her name is Gyaza Sawa Wudrun. She was a Chinese woman. She passed on these teachings to her disciple. The natural state, and I use the natural state synonymously with Buddha nature or awareness. The natural state is like great nectar or medicine. It's like great nectar or medicine. External phenomenal existence, as well as internal sentient beings, whoever, wherever they may be, are connected with this. Whatever appears is a kind of nectar and medicine. Whatever appears, whether good or bad, is sealed by the natural state. Nothing exists beyond the natural state, and the natural state is great nectar. Whatever appears is a kind of nectar and medicine. How can we abide in this, practice, and know this? It's not possible to know it by means of consciousness or perception. Because consciousness and perception depend on duality. Consciousness has objects of consciousness. But this is not an object of consciousness. Anything that's an object of consciousness is just going to go away. That's why the teachings say don't hanker after a special state. Because if it comes in the front door, it's going to go out the back. What did it come through? By what means does it arrive? How can we abide in this, practice, and know this? It is not possible to know it by consciousness or perception. Simply leave it as it is, vast and spacious, open and free. Leave it. Leave it. Don't try to grasp or perceive anything. That is nectar. That's nectar? That's it? Don't try to grasp or perceive anything. That is nectar. If you do this, you have received the great nectar medicine of Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya means the body of Dharma, or the body of truth. You have received the great nectar medicine of the true body, which can purify and clean everything. Obscurations, defilements, misery, sufferings, these are all purified. Therefore, it is called nectar, amrita. That is the teaching. And there's the koan, Unman's Medicine and Sickness. Actually, the title of the koan is Medicine and Sickness Cure Each Other. Unman said to the disciples, medicine and sickness cure each other. Again, as you hear this, it's always about you. It's always about me. Medicine and sickness cure each other. All the earth is medicine. All the earth is medicine. Where do you find yourself? Medicine and sickness cure each other. all the earth is medicine. That means everything. Everything is medicine. Where do you find yourself? So the usual way we judge whether something is good or bad, and whether things are on track or off track, right or wrong, is whether we like how it feels. Whether we like how it feels, that's our usual habitual barometer. And things that feel good, we want to do them. But when we no longer find them to feel good, which is true about everything, isn't it? Is there anything that always feels good? Sex doesn't always feel good. Sex can be deeply painful, emotionally, physically. Food doesn't always feel good. Food can be poison. So things that feel good, we want to do them, but when we no longer find them to feel good, then our opinions about that thing change. And the thing that was so good, it becomes hollow, or it becomes threatening. So, or maybe we get sorry, I'm trying to read my own handwriting. Oh, maybe we get into a self-strategy or an identity of having difficulty. We become identified with difficulty. We find that struggling against life gives us substance. Things are hard and I have purpose. I can stand up straight. Grit my teeth, I can bore through it. And so we believe life should be difficult, and so that belief tends to influence what we do. And so we confirm life is difficult. Sometimes people even move towards pain as a strategy to be able to feel alive. A little bit of that can be really skillful. Too much of that, not so helpful. So struggling against life gives us some sense of substance, basically buffers the ego. But then if what was difficult flips over, we might just reject it out and out. If the problem actually resolves, the ease that could be there, we quickly find something else to have a problem with, something else to get entangled with. One of the questions you face in this practice is that, am I really interested in being at peace? What are the implications of being at peace? Not the sacrifices that it might take to create conditions to be at peace, but what are the sacrifices internally if we embody that state? You may be afraid of peace. May be afraid of the implications. So, but of course, challenge and rising to meet challenge gives meaningfulness to life. It's not conceptual. I think there's something satisfying about owning our capacity to really make it through something challenging, to not crumble, or even if we do crumble, to decrumble, to sit up once again, to get up. So rising to meet challenge gives some meaningfulness to life. It's stating the obvious. But anger and freedom from anger can't be separated. We don't learn about calm without facing anxiety. They only have meaning in relationship. We don't have the joy of confidence without times of doubt and just confusion. Purpose in life is trivial if we've never really had to wrestle with the feeling of meaninglessness. So Oman said, medicine and sickness cure each other. The whole world is medicine. Where do you find yourself? What determines whether what you're experiencing is medicine or sickness? Medicine can taste bitter. Sickness can be bitter. Medicine can taste sweet. Sickness can taste sweet. All the world is medicine. All the world is medicine. The koan tradition, which is sort of like the oral transmission of Zen. It's like the insider's guide to the galaxy of Zen. It's like people who have digested the tradition, this is what came out of their mouth when they talked about their practice. So it's a way to really kind of get to the essence in a very human way. But the koans are very much informed by the scriptures, because the people in the koans were very much informed and having digested the scriptures. So that teaching all the world is medicine comes from the Avatamsaka Sutra. It's this great scripture. It's great in its meaning, and it's great in that it's like this long. It's only been fully translated once or almost twice, because it's quite an undertaking. So in the great Avatamsaka scripture, there's this archetypal young seeker who plays a primary role in one section of it, Zenzai. And Zenzai, being an archetypal seeker, was willing to receive teachings from everybody. The love of truth was so strong that the discrimination, that was long abandoned, like, oh, does she know? Does he know? He's too old. She's too. Just like Master Joshu, you probably heard that Master Joshu went on pilgrimage well into his senior years. And the famous saying, if a 7-year-old girl can teach me the Dharma, I will bow to her. And if an old man can teach me the Dharma, I will bow to him, or I will teach him. So anyway, Zenzai was just wide open. Ripe. And because of that ripeness, he encountered Manjushri Bodhisattva. So a vision of Manjushri Bodhisattva. The Manjushri Bodhisattva is the archetype of wisdom. That's the image at the door here. Manjushri Bodhisattva has tamed the lion of the mind, and so now gets to ride freely. So Zenzai was asked by Manjushri Bodhisattva, the archetype of transcendent wisdom. Manjushri challenged Zenzai and said, bring me something that is not medicine. That was his koan. I want you to bring me something that is not medicine. So what did Manjushri see in Zenzai? Be Manjushri and reflect. What state of mind was Manjushri addressing? What was that state of mind? Was Zenzai's state of mind medicine? Was his state of mind sickness? Was he sick with seeking? There's this thing called Dharma sickness. It's when you're so in love with the concepts of Buddhism, you're so in love with the ideas and the philosophy, which is, it's really quite exquisite. It all fits together. You're so in love with it that you can't let go of it and encounter the real thing. And so you contract Dharma sickness. In the Tibetan tradition, some of you know, there's these pills. I think they're called ditsi, blessing pills. And it's a substance that you're sometimes given, maybe by a teacher or in a ritual. And these pills are some combination of healing herbs, the infusion of prayers and mantras, as well as some excrement from the lama, from different orifices, and a little bit of a poisonous plant, all in one pill. So the young seeker went off and searched exhaustively. Searched exhaustively. And Zenzai came back and told Manjushri, I can't find a single thing that is not medicine. I can't find a single thing in this world that could not be a medicine. So then Manjushri asked him, well, I want you to bring me something that definitely is a medicine. Zenzai said, the whole world is medicine. I can't find anything that's not medicine. Manjushri said, I want you to bring me something that definitely is medicine. So Zenzai gave him a single stalk of grass. And he just reached down, plucked it, and handed it to him. Then Manjushri liked that, and he held it up and said, this single stalk of grass can give life and can take it away. This single stalk of grass. What is that blade of grass? So when we put ourselves into practice, we often lose the fixed sense of what is what. We might not know up from down. The compassion you feel when you turn your mind to the situation of the world. To whatever situation touches. Is that compassion medicine? Or sickness? In our ordinary state of mind, we see that medicine can cure sickness. As soon as we get sick, we look for some kind of medicine. Sick in the mind, sick in the body, sick in the heart, we seek a medicine. But how about when sickness cures medicine? They cure each other. How is it that sickness cures medicine? That which heals, that which brings relief, how is it liberated? How is it healed? The whole world is medicine. Where do you find yourself? The whole world is medicine. Where do you find yourself? Which one is it? You chant it each night during the session. May I be doctor, nurse, and medicine for sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. May I be doctor, nurse, and medicine for sick beings in the world until everyone is healed. Who's being mended here? Who's being mended here? Back to Hungzhir. One remembrance of illumination can break through and leap out of the dust of eons. Radiant and clear, it cannot be diverted or altered in the three times. The four elements cannot modify it. One remembrance of illumination can break through and leap out of the dust of eons. One glimpse, one moment of real seeing what this practice can do, that can be enough to turn a life around. That one glimmer can be enough. could the Buddha possibly believe in lost causes? Could the Buddha believe in lost causes? The self is a pattern. Self is a pattern woven moment by moment. And anything woven can't be opaque. Anything that's woven moment by moment can't keep light from shining through. Very intent sometimes on attaining enlightenment, but it's also true that you can never avoid it. Hongzhir continues, solitary glory is deeply preserved, enduring throughout ancient and present times, as the merging of sameness and difference becomes the entire creation's mother. When I first read that one, I just said, whoa, that's a mouthful. Solitary glory is deeply preserved, enduring throughout ancient and present times, as the merging of sameness and difference becomes the entire creation's mother. So in the morning chant, we say, the dark makes all words one. The dark. What goes dark when you disregard and let settle the labeling mind? What goes dark when you disregard and let settle the narrating mind? What goes dark when you even let go and let settle the mind that very subtly whispers, me, not me. Me, not me. And what lights up in that delicious disregard? There is some kind of pattern to how meditation unfolds. There's some kind of pattern, but it's more like a watercolor. It's more like a rough sketch or like a collage. There's a pattern to how practice unfolds. We move from estranged knowing, that is, we only know things through this just the cloud of thought, the cloud of reactivity. Or practice, some people have never actually experienced their body. They've never actually heard the birds. They've never actually tasted what's on their spoon. It's clouded over. So we move from a strange knowing of experience. We move to a more direct knowing of experience. More direct, we're in contact. We gather attention and we're with the breath. With the breath, that gathering and that energy overwhelms or is stronger than shines through whatever clouds or mist of thought. And so we really start to experience in its nakedness, its immediacy, the texture of this life. Start to taste things just as they are. It's a certain plain and simple refreshment. It's something we've been thirsty for. So we move into direct knowing of experience. We stay with that. Bring it together, that which knows and that which is known, they're really like intertwined lovers. You're so involved in that act, you don't quite know who is who. You're so immersed in the flow of breath or the soundscape, just sitting, just aware. That that you don't really know anymore. You don't really know. Knowing implies you're distant. Sort of like when you hold something in your hand. If you hold a coin in your hand for long enough, you forget you're holding it, but the sensation is still there. You haven't dropped it. The sensation is still there. Something reminds you, oh yeah, it's right here on my palm. So this is a place that often a lot of fear comes up. Because knowing is a way, maybe one of the last ways that we hold on to being somebody, to being somebody separate. It's back to what the Buddha said about views. If I know something, I have some power, I have some safety. I don't have to forfeit my territory. I don't have to let go of the illusion that I really know. And so we move into transparency. Sometimes called the stage of faith. Because when you become your Zazen, there's no checking. There's no feedback. After the fact, you return inevitably to your relative condition, the ordinary discriminating mind, and there's some sense of, okay, now this. But in the midst of it, you can't check, you can't know. Or you're trying to know, you feel that sense of trying to witness your own meditation. Trungpa said it's like trying to witness your own death. Another image from the koans is letting go off the precipice. It's like you're hanging, you're dangling, and you can feel the quality of space all around you. And what is it that takes us from this to the blessing of free fall? So there's the mode of estranged knowing, the mode of more direct knowing, the mode of beyond knowing, and then there's the plain naked fact of just experience. Just experience. Colors, sounds, light, dark, pressure, firmness, space. It's not an esoteric fact that the body is a concept. What is your experience of the body? Pressure, coolness, color, space, warmth, movement. You say, my body, but that label doesn't land on anything. It only lands on something if you don't really look. It only lands in that estranged mode of knowing. So the naked fact of experience, and perfect is saying too much. So each mode has its effort. And it's like a circle. It's not like you need to get from point A to Z. Each mode has its effort, and each mode turns over. Each mode reveals the next, brings forth the next. Where's your power? Sincerity brings us to this point where we're like, what can I do? You sit in your longing. You sit in your ache of separation. But eventually the strategies, they're not convincing. What can possibly be done? What can I do? At that time, what is your power? Where do you have effect? Hongzhi ends, this realm of awake awareness, this realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings. This realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings. All appearances, this field's light, truly enact this reality. This realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings. All appearances, this field's light, truly enact this reality. What's alive in you is alive in everything. What's awake in you is a mystery for you, it's a mystery for me. And what's a mystery? A mystery is that which can't be encapsulated in words. Mystery is that which always is larger than all of our attempts to grasp, all of our attempts to avoid. This realm manifests the energy of the many thousands of beings. That's us. Everyone is lit up by the unsayable. What lights you up? This consciousness that you know directly and intimately as anything you'll ever know. What is that mystery? Please sit with curiosity. Please sit with faith. Please sit with intimate trust in that which you already are. That's your power. That's where you have effect.